I'm truly blessed, I feel, to have this conversation with you, John. I actually met John about 6 weeks ago in Phoenix, and when I saw him, I felt a few things. First was, wow, thank God I'm not the only big guy in this room. John is this sort of towering man with this silver hair and a ponytail and a sort of Herculean build. And then the second thought I thought was, wow, he's got really gentle eyes, and they seem to have a lot of depth to them. And really, what I found out over the next few days was that was really an understatement. And so, after spending some time with him, it just seemed that wisdom just seemed to pour out of him. And what was even more notable was his humility and reverence for all the things that have really come before him. John's a really learned man, but I'm not really referring to a list of degrees and credentials, though he has those as well. He's seen many difficult and beautiful aspects of life, and he's often at the intersection of both. His beautiful partner, Mia, who unfortunately couldn't be on the call with us today, had this to say about John. She says, I think that one of the most important things that John has done has been running the community day school for many years. And the school is made up of kids that had failed every other institution, but succeeded at the Foundry under John's counsel. And after he left, though the school didn't quite function the same, John has continued to support a number of individuals, including a parent support group, which he continues to do today. And another big part of John's life is his 500-mile relay. And so we're hoping to hear about a lot of those things today. And John, I just wanted to welcome you first, and I'm very, very happy to have you here on the call with us.
Hey.
Yeah, I wish we were all outside at a fire and we got to look in the fire's eyes and each other's, but we'll make the best of it today.
Absolutely. Where I wanted to start really was, you had started your sort of path at a young age working at the county probation department as a senior group counselor, and you were only 21 at the time. And it was there where you used to do group therapy for inmates and make peace with the victims' families and their own families. And you also sought sort of to guarantee prisoner rights for safety and self-expression. And of all of the veritable career paths one could choose, how did you decide to become a group counselor really at such a young age?
I guess intuitively, having my own children early, having two children, needing to work, and my own life having a period of incarceration where lose everything, and then you come to a moment of truth and you see things aren't the way they should be. And make a promise to yourself that I'm going to make something wrong right. And so when I had a chance to work with Santa Clara Juvenile Probation, I went in and the big body always comes up, but to me, I don't feel big that way. And I never relied on my power, I would say, my physical power. It was more my intuition. So when I went in there, I worked in the oldest boys unit, the security unit, and all those guys pretty much were in custody, and they were going to be going to California Youth Authority, which is basically they would become state raised. And so the name of the game when I walked in was just custody and supervision, and I knew that wasn't the answer. That should be off the top if the kids respected you. You could really prepare them for a long period of incarceration. They can make their amends, get it right with their family and everything. So basically, in a very short period, over 9 months, the other counselors working there with a lot more seniority turned to me and said, would you lead us in a direction? So we created a therapeutic community, and it became known as the family, and people that were afraid to work the unit, all of a sudden started petitioning to work the unit, and it was all based on the circle. And at that time, we'd have two counselors and 110 kids. We didn't have enough beds for the kids, and it was pretty severe. So the severity left when we started doing a circle, and talking circle. And in a talking circle, you have to listen. And the whole idea, Creator gave one mouth and two ears. The power of circle allows a heart to be shared with each other, and after the sharing starts healing, everyone knows they're going to get their turn. And pretty soon the racism, the hatred between different cliques, it started softening, and then we went from there. So those kids really taught me to trust my intuition, and they taught me that they weren't criminals. They were young men who didn't have the skills to make a good decision in like a 50-second period. They chose a disease, you know, that they've been taught on the street, and they've been taught in their dysfunctional homes. So it kind of went from there, and after about 7 years, it became clear to me we needed a school in the community to replace the security unit so that judges would have an option and could choose something softer. So we started a school called the Foundry, which is taken after the name of, you know, you take discarded metal and you do a seven-step process, including firing it up and making a mold and design. And so that's been, that was the center of my life for 30 years, is helping direct and be a team member of this school.
Wow. And I guess, you know, coming across, you know, some of this youth, I mean, I guess maybe if it would help for a lot of the folks on the call to get an understanding of, you know, some of the environments in which some of these individuals came from, their backgrounds, maybe some of the difficulties they came from. And then I guess the second part of that is, how did you find a way to connect to these individuals, especially if you didn't come from that background? You know, because often, you know, people are angry, they're frustrated, and to be able to even gather a level of respect for them to even listen to you. You know, if you come from a similar background, maybe you have that. So I guess maybe if you can speak to maybe some of their backgrounds and then kind of how you were able to really connect with them.
Well, you know, like they say, no one goes undefeated in the street. And actually, you know, I grew up in New York, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco after 12 years living outside the country in places like China and Indonesia and Europe. And so I saw a lot of asphalt, though. You know, I noticed no one makes it on the street, and I was lucky. I came across some people who introduced me to the natural world, and I just found, you know, I was really alive in that situation. So I also noticed that psychology didn't work with kids. You know, we've made a mistake, and we just look at our body as a machine. So there's more to us than that. So that's what I've always driven to. So I was never fooled by the personality of a kid. That's like considered the veil to the soul. So I always went for the soul. So it doesn't matter who you are. If you're authentic, you will make a connection, whether it's with an addict, whether it's with a murderer, whether it's with a person who's totally withdrawn, if you authentically present yourself. So when you're working in an institution, you know, you don't have anything but each other. And the trust can come much quicker than on the street and stuff. So it's easier work in the institution than it was in the school we formed, where you have a kid comes from a home that, you know, no one says goodbye to. They come from a home where, you know, there's no dad to look across the dining room table for a role model and that sort of thing. So, you know, people are just put in these positions and do the best they can. So I work with what I would say was the urban wounded, and you know, everyone starts out on the short end of the stick or as a victim, and then too many become the perpetrator. They take what happened to them and they duplicate it and amplify it. So where do you look for answers, and I found the answers didn't lie in psychology. It didn't lie in that. It lied more in mythological roots, more in cultural traditions and rituals and that sort of thing. So I had the nerve to try that, and my practice ground was really the institution, and every day we did circle, and the circles would be 3 or 4 hours, and the kids wanted more. So kids are in desperate situations, and they're in more desperate situations now than they were when I first started in 68. So if you got a heart,
why do you think that is? What do you think has changed so much? I mean, aside from our fast-moving, fast-paced world, but I mean, is there anything that's distinctly different?
Elders would say, like, information and data. It's replaced insight. They say it's self-destructive to split the holy and the ordinary. So where in our lives today do we have room for ritual or ceremony? It's been forgotten that life is like a sacred adventure. And spiritual, you know, people look at it as more esoteric and that sort of thing. And spiritual, to me, it means you bring meaning to your everyday life. You know, like we all know Pancho does, you know, just as you go through life, you practice and you develop your spirit. We've kind of reduced the soul to human behavior, DNA. The body, like I was saying, we just look at it as a machine. And so these kids who had trauma, if you approach them just through the mind or just through drugs and the body's left out and the body is screaming, you know, the body has a sense about it, has a feeling about it, it has a knowing about it. So I always push people to include the body, don't overlook it. And when that starts happening, there's a lot of healing. You know, we have an innate capacity to heal. So a lot of our practice, modern day practices, is we string people out. You know, they stay in therapy forever and that sort of thing. What we've been doing is teaching people, doctor yourself, become your own doctor, become your, you know, learn to be a warrior, learn to be a teacher, a visionary. Take your pain, turn it into your medicine. And so take responsibility for all that. No one can steal your spirit. You know, it doesn't matter how long your spirits lie dormant. One day, you know, you'll hear us playing a drum, or you'll hear a song, you'll pick up an object, and pretty soon you'll see a vision, you'll feel your spirit come alive. Then you're on your way, you know, and then we've done our job, and you help the next person.
You know, you talked about healing, and I know that for decades you spent some of your time as a volunteer cuddler, holding newborns in a hospital in the Bay Area. And so wanted to know what sort of prompted you towards that sort of particular form of service, and really if you could share a little bit about the importance of touch in the healing process.
Well, Lucille Packard Hospital, she was a visionary, and she realized, you know, we need a place for children. It's not like a hospital. And so I admired this place because no matter who you are, they could fly your child up in a helicopter to the hospital if you lived in Guatemala, whatever. Cost was not a barrier. So I admired this place. And at the same time, I felt like I was getting too self-absorbed. I just... I had lost some sight in my left eye. My job was being threatened, so I was focused on me. And one day, I just felt kind of disgusted that I was indulging in my own story, and it was not allowing me to be feel as connected. And I think some of that was depression. It was, staying home and not being able to drive for 9 months or walk or anything because of my eye, not being able to go up over 3,000 feet. So then I had two friends who had had children there, and basically because I was a male, I didn't have to wait on a two-year waiting list like women do because they needed males. There were no males, so very few applied. So when I was allowed to go through my training and work there, I note I chose to work at 9, starting 9 at night, and then in past 1 in the morning. And the reason I did that is I knew that's the time when people choose to live or die, including, I believe, young children. So I felt like, yes, my voice actually was as important as the touch. And so I knew a lot of chants. I knew a lot of that. So I would sing to the babies, and they're 27 weeks or younger. You know, you usually can't touch a 1 or 1.5 pound child, or you will hurt them, not help them. So, but you can be present with them. So sound I could use with someone like that. But then the 2 pounders, the 3 pounders, even if you couldn't pick them up, you could put your hand through to the incubator. And so whenever I went in there, which was all the time for 9 years, I always knew I had to keep myself clean so I didn't pass on anything to them that was negative. So actually those little guys kept me pure. They kept me clean because I made sure I was always clean when I went in there. I didn't want to take tiredness in there. So I noticed there's babies that were actually felt heavy, and they might only be 4 pounds. There were other babies that felt light. So those ones that felt heavy, I knew I had to make them feel lighter. And so I found myself, touching them different than the ones who were lighter. So I don't know if that answers the question some, but within those walls, I was just so inspired that parents' lives were turned upside down, and instead of worrying about all the details, they just surrounded their child, and they were going to accept their child. They wanted to live no matter how major the disability, and that was just striking. So as far as helping the children, helping the parents, I felt was one of my gifts because I knew when to be quiet and I knew when to ask a question. And anyone who's in danger of losing someone, they need a chance to express themselves. They say depression is a lack of expression, and that's really true within institutional walls, I think. And the other thing was the nurses. I'd never worked with so many women, and I rarely saw a man on my shifts, and the women just taking turns. You know, someone had to go get a tube or something. The other person says, "I got you." And it was just built in where the women just worked cooperatively, and there was no competition like often, you know, when men are working together. So that really benefited me and matured me in terms of my work life. I'll stop there.
I know that Nipun actually wanted to jump in here as well. He had a
question. I got you. I'm sorry, I was on mute. I was speaking. John, I was wondering if you had a particular instance of a child or a story that really, you know, really touched you and resonated with you. I've heard some of these stories from you, and you just have so many incredible encounters with these kids, and people who even watch you with these kids have these beautifully poetic descriptions of how you enter into a different space of communion with them. So I was wondering if you could share a story of a particular, a particular child that left an impression on you.
Would that be with the cuddlers? Or
yeah.
More a father. I don't know if I've told you this story. There were two twins born at about 23 weeks, and one lived and one died. And the father blamed the hospital, and particularly a doctor, for one of the children dying. So while one kid was living and needed the father's love and support, he couldn't give it because he was so angry at the doctors and stuff. So I had a chance to hold his living son and stuff. He came in the room, and who's this holding my son? And he liked the way I passed the son to him, but all he wanted to talk about was he was thinking of hurting this doctor. So I'm thinking, what's my responsibility? You know, this man's in pain. I don't want to criminalize him. I don't want to make it worse. I want to be his ally at the same time. I know every doctor is giving everything they have to save his child, and his child was meant to go to the spirit world. So so I kept focusing on that, and over the next few weeks, I got a chance to ask the father, was there ever a moment in that short period of time where your son was alive that you guys connected? And he got real quiet. And then he said, yes. He looked at me, and I looked at him. And I said, tell me about it. And he went in this story about how they were so connected. After that moment, he didn't talk about anger, about the doctor and stuff. He was ready to be present for his son that was still living. And so then, you know, I offered, you know, to help him do a ceremony with the son that passed on, and that led to he understood that son could be his coach, his guide, so he knew not to be too hard or not too soft, just stay in the middle with that son and his family that was alive. They needed him. So that sort of thing happened kind of on a regular basis.
You know, John, I wanted to come back to something that you had...
Could you speak a little louder?
Yep, sorry about that. I said I wanted to come back to something that you had mentioned earlier in regard to, I think you had mentioned ritual at some point. And, you know, you've worked very closely in this sort of the spirit of brotherhood with many different Native American communities from... I know Native American Lakota teachers, and all of who have a rich sort of culture of ceremony and ritual. And our era seems to have lost touch with that. And so I was wondering if you can tell us, you know, where you see the place of ritual in today's world, and what are some of the daily rituals you practice in your own life?
Okay. Yeah, I've been blessed starting in, well, I worked within a lot of Indian children, and their fathers were incarcerated. Their mothers were usually available, so I kind of got a reputation for being a good man. I was given the name Chante Waste by the Dakota people because that means good heart, because they saw me working with children. That was my life work. I hardly spent any time with adults. I spent it with children most of my life when I look back. So based on just working with children and making safe places for kids to be kids and being an advocate for them, I started being recognized by the indigenous community. So one person, it's interesting because he was the last man off of Alcatraz as a prisoner, federal prison. I had taught three of his children. He was also someone who had picked up a major heroin addict as when he was at he was a veteran, a Vietnam veteran. He started selling heroin internationally. So naturally, he eventually was arrested. That sort of thing. But he was a great spirit. He was an Apache, and you know, he's one of those Apaches and they never laid his gun down, they kind of say. So most people saw him as reckless and all these things, but a lot of the people that I see acting out, they're warriors or misdirected. They have their power taken from them, and so they misuse their power and they became bullies and are intimidators and those sorts of things. But like they say, that's a person with a big heart that just needs to be directed. They need to learn how to stand for something that's going to benefit those that come from behind them. So I kind of played that role in his life. So he wanted to come back in the community. He wanted to be a father, that sort of thing. So I was his doorway for that. So he said, I want to thank you and I want to invite you on a sacred run. And so I didn't realize when I said I would be honored that it meant 4 years. It was a 4-year commitment. So that was in 1978, and it was a run across California. And that run was conceived by Dennis Banks, co-founder of American Indian Movement, when he could not leave California. He'd be arrested, and he had a 250-year sentence hanging over him from his freedom work, basically in South Dakota, connected with Wounded Knee, the second Wounded Knee, and where the FBI and the federal government invaded Pine Ridge Reservation and Rosebud and those places. So he invited me to that, and I just stayed with it 4 years, 8 years, and now 34 years later. So I direct the run. I have my teachers, and they teach me my responsibilities. So that run is now open to all four directions, so all races are invited. It makes a more powerful run when we do it together than just separate. And that run is very important today. It's not just symbolic. So we ran 25 miles southern run. Now we run northern from the Oregon border down towards Sacramento area. In this past year, we've just been discovering California Trail of Tears, where the cavalry wiped out up to 6 different tribes. So when you hear an Ishi, the last, quote, wild Indian, his nation, all these nations that were slaughtered, our run actually goes through those areas, and they're the relatives of these people we're now acknowledging, and they do exist. So it's like seeing a picture come back, a picture from the past, and their rituals and ceremonies have been kept. So when we run, their young Indian children will join our run for a day, and we run 100 miles in a day in teams of 8 and 10 through hills, through plains, through beautiful places, and we bring hope. So we call it a running prayer, and our responsibility is to keep alive ritual and ceremony, because in 1977, the grandmas, the warrior society, the elders came together and said, how are we going to save the water? How are we going to save the air and the earth? And a decision was made that cannot be done through economics. It cannot be done through politics. It can only be done by saving the rituals and the ceremonies, the customs. That's what we want our children to have. With that, they will know that nature's to be respected, and from that, all the cultural myths, all the ceremony will remind people you have a spirit. No one can steal your spirit. It's in you, so use it. Live a spirit life. So hope I didn't get too off.
No, that's beautiful. And John, if you don't mind, I'm going to have you speak up just a little bit, because I know that some of our callers. No. Some of our callers are deeply listening in, and so they're hanging on to your every word. And so, no, this is absolutely beautiful. One of the things I wanted to sort of dive into, I guess, here as well is more into the run a little bit. You said that you run for hope. I mean, is this run dedicated to anyone in particular? Is it, you know, it.
This run, the theme of this run is always all life is sacred. So Lakota word is Om Itakiase. We're all related. So that means the animals, the plant world, the mineral world, the people world. We're all related. And so if we ever start getting depressed or we ever start getting anger, basically, we look like we're cutting the connection to nature, to the natural world. We're part of it, so we're hurting ourselves. So over the years, it's always been all life is sacred, and it's taken the form where in the beginning, drugs and alcohol were destroying the lives of Indian people. So our message was no drugs and alcohol. Those were our beginning messages. And then that's very instilled in the native community. No drugs or alcohol is allowed in any ceremony or ritual. And there's security to guarantee that no one interrupts those ceremonies by becoming drunk or that sort of thing. And then the message really, right now, part of the message is diabetes is reversible. So basically we learn a lot about drugs and alcohol, about diabetes, all these different issues, and we go to the rancherias and the reservations and we ask them what they know and to teach us what they know, and then we come and say, well, here's what we found out as we've been going from place to place. So we're the collectors of stories, we're the collectors of songs, we're the collectors of dances, and every night after we run all day, then we share dances, songs, stories, all the healing arts. Presently, our main theme is Save Sacred Sites, and there's over 178 active sacred sites that across the United States, people are trying to save. They're putting their bodies on the line. They're willing to go to jail, whatever it takes to say, we won't let you desecrate this place. And most of these sacred sites have been places people have gone forever for their vision quest, to find out what their medicine is, what they're supposed to do with their lives, and they can't be disturbed with geothermal drilling. They can't be destroyed by building a shopping center on top of a shell mound, like in Berkeley. In Berkeley, one of the busiest places, Highway 80, was one of the tallest shell mounds in North America, and a developer knowingly built a large shopping center there, and they named the street Shell Mound. And so that same developer now is buying an island that is a sacred island up in a place called Clear Lake, California. And, so this is active. This is going on daily. People are trying to protect these places. So our run is very important because it's lasted 34 years. So everyone knows it's kind of the central nervous system. If you really want to be relevant, you want to know what's going on. Our runners have dedicated their lives, so we know a lot of the issues, and if we don't know the issues, we know who does. So at the same time, we see ourselves as spiritual runners, so that means we have to stay humble. We have to be nonviolent. So nonviolence is part of our training. We don't just train to run. We train by service. So we go into the prisons with a 36-inch drum. We take fresh salmon. We take medicine food, the venison of the deer, those things, into prisoners who don't get to be Indian in there. You know, they're forced to cut their hair. If they don't cut their hair, they put them in the hole, and they add to their prison time. That's still going on today. We go into the hospitals and take our running staffs and ask the sick to put prayers in there, and we tell them we'll send a runner out to run until the next day and bring that staff back and do something hard to take the pain from them. So pain is considered, we don't look at it as we came here to suffer. Pain teaches us to have strong medicine, to clean ourselves up, to need less so someone else can have more. So it's pretty related to, you know, everything that's happening in service space. It's there's no separation. We're part of that.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, John. I could just sit and listen to you for hours and hours. I need to open this up for Q&A though. So anyone who has questions, just hit *6 and then you will be put on the queue.
Can you speak a little louder, Kashan?
Oh, sorry. Hi, John. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Can you hear me, John?
A little bit, yeah.
Okay. So we are just opening up for Q&A, and people are welcome to hit *6 to join the queue, and then they can ask you some questions. We are going to start with Nipun.
Okay. Thank you.
John,
hi.
Thank you again for sharing. It's been great, and I'm so glad that coordinators from around the world are getting the benefit of you, what we get every week. This past Sunday, you participated in the AIDS Walk in SF, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, and it's something you've done for 15 years. And so I was wondering if you could share, I mean, you always seem to go and create community wherever you are. And I was just wondering, what was there a personal connection to the AIDS Walk that has, continued your consistent participation? And if you could share the reason beyond that and maybe the medicine there that you were trying to bring to it.
It's nice to have an opportunity. I'm a father who lost a son to AIDS. So in 1983, my son died after he was diagnosed a year and a half prior. And so basically I rearranged my life and my family did. And he was able to die at home in hospice care. And so that led me to do hospice work for VNA, Visiting Nurse Association. My son, he's back then, people really didn't know about AIDS if you were a teenager. So he caught AIDS as a teenager, and he was in pretty strong denial, and the doctors asked me to be the one to tell him he had AIDS. And he and I were, no matter what happened, he's my son, so, it's just unconditional love. So we went through everything together, and taking care of him was, it was an honor, and he became my teacher. So even today, people think it's sad, but for me it's not. It's inspirational because he really made his amends before he died. He used to live in the fast lane, live in West Hollywood. He was living the life, and when he picked up the disease. And then he's saying, why does it matter if I live? He wanted to die, so he tried suicide 2 times. And why does it matter if he lives? So I took him to a shaman, and he said, I'll do it, Dad, if you do it. So we channeled a shaman, and the person was really kind of like a St. Francis of Assisi's figure. And my son always loved animals. He always loved gardening and stuff. And he said, why does it matter what I do? I'm going to die anyway. And the person said, no, you need to clean up before you leave or you'll start again, all over again. And somehow that resonated with him, so he gave away everything. He gave away his goldfish. He gave away his clothes.
Wow.
He gave away everything and basically became the artist he was meant to be, and he started painting a series of paintings on pain, and he gave each one to the family. But what I'm trying to tell you is he became the teacher. So today, for me, I always look to him. I listen for his voice, and he tells me how hard to go and push it, how much to take care of myself. So my family, we all said we're going to keep his spirit alive, because a father's worst or a mother's worst dream is that people will forget that you had a son and who this person was. So doing the AIDS walk is part of that. I also cut flowers every week, and when I cut flowers every week, that's my ritual to keep my son present in my home. But this Sunday when we did the AIDS walk, there are all kinds of young people supporting that AIDS walk, which raises millions of dollars every year, and over 20,000 people walk. And a lot of the people who are walking are no longer here. They've died of AIDS. So we had a bunch of young high school kids, you know, having fun and all like that, and it was part of their community service, just beautiful kids and stuff. But at the right time, I was able to tell them the history of the AIDS walk. And when my son had it, it was a death penalty. There were no cocktails. There was nothing. We knew it was a death penalty. And so that was hanging over our heads. So what do you do when you know your life's short? And so my son prepared us. He stayed around long enough to prepare us to accept he was going to die. And we accepted it, and at that moment, everything changed. You know, life, I could see flowers had more color. I could taste the air better. So that's because, we got a lot of help, but hospice in particular. So I made hospice my life for years, and then I decided 10 years ago that I wanted to be on the front side. So I started working with children that were born premature. So, yeah. That's part of it.
Well, thanks for sharing that, John.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, John. We have next Pancho on the call. Pancho?
Hi, Pancho.
Hey, Brother John. It's so wonderful to see how you facilitated you and your son going back to simplicity and just to feel the texture of your voice. I know that we can now be seeing each other as I love how Amit said that, you know, the gentleness and kindness of your eyes, and we can say whatever, but that's an understatement. But I can feel the texture of your voice, and I feel really, really moved, brother. It's beautiful to once again be embedded in your wisdom. And I was wondering, given that you said how important is to really embody nonviolence in the work that you're doing, and you didn't even say the word nonviolence, but when you're carrying those babies and the babies that feel heavy and the babies that feel light, and how you were connecting with this father and supporting the Native American family and bringing all these like fears, love and courage, and you've been also working with a lot of giants and monsters of love and nonviolence, like Cesar Chavez and Martin Luther King Jr. So I was wondering if there's something that you would like to share with us in any of your experiences with Cesar or Martin, or anything that you think could be of service for the listeners here and all over the planet.
Well, I'd like to honor Cesar Chavez, and you know, so many people don't know who Cesar Chavez is, but you know, he died the same year as my son, and I take note of that. But I first met him in 1978 in a place called La Paz. It's a peace compound, and it's below Bakersfield, California. And that was founded for people who were out in the fields and got sick and needed to come and rest. And then eventually the leadership went there and said, we're going to live there. So Cesar Chavez's family, when he died, they had to make a decision, where will we bury him? Hmm. And they decided to bury him in the mountains of Tehachapi called La Paz. Well, Cesar, you know, he was, you know, the book I just gave you, it tells you a lot of this, but he was a small person, and he didn't have a lot of physical strength, and he was sick at a lot of different times, but what he had was a great determination, a persistence and stuff. So his family was farm workers, and they picked everything, and he saw the injustice. And farm workers in California, I mean, it's amazing, because the rich want organic food and all like this, but the first people to say our food is poison, you're poisoning your children, your milk is poison that you're feeding from your breast, you need to change, you need to stop this, was the farm workers who, you know, their children were being aborted in their fetus because of they were taking in the chemicals that were sprayed on our foods. So Cesar was the one to say, you know, we deserve clean water. We deserve a place to sleep in. I've seen families of 18 sleeping under a tree if they were lucky, with no bathrooms and stuff. This is modern times. So Cesar used all the nonviolent tactics to wake up the consciousness of the middle class and the material world and the people who have more than they need. And he did it through boycotts, don't buy grapes. He did it through fasting. He had three major fasts in his life, which eventually killed him because it weakened his heart. If you fast for 33 days, 38 days, you'll start, your body will tear down instead of build. And so he did all of these things, but when I first met him, I went to two great leaders, Dennis Banks of the American Indian Movement and Cesar Chavez, the founder, along with Dolores Huerta. They made an agreement that the run will start at United Farm Workers headquarters in La Paz. That's to honor the United Farm Workers for all the work they do for all of us. And so the Indian and the Mexican people came together. We start our run there every year for 25 years to honor United Farm Workers and Cesar's leadership. Well, he would get up. We would start the run as soon as the sun comes up, and we would run till the sun goes down. That's 14 hours a day. He would get up at 3, 3:30 in the morning, personally cook us tortillas, pancakes, and give it to each runner. So it turns out his people are connected. He's directly connected with the Tar Mahar runners, who are considered the greatest runners ever. They live in Copper Canyon.
Yeah, the barefoot runners, yeah.
Yeah, and so we now have people running with the Tar Mahar down there. So Cesar Chavez, he never made it more than $6,800 in a year. I knew him the whole time he was alive, from 68 until he died in 93. And he always had the same shirt. And his teachers, if you look at his bookshelf, it was filled with Gandhi, all the great leaders, Mother Teresa. Those were his teachers. He was a vegan, not only a vegetarian. So I hope that honors him a little bit. But he is our teacher when it comes to nonviolence, because he was in situations where people were being literally shot for picketing, beaten, you know. So he never surrendered. He just said, we need to draw back, we need to pray. And he always said, you don't stop working to pray. You pray while you work. So he never stopped working.
Well, John, I'd like to make an announcement here in your honor and what you just said. since today it is, what is this? This is Saturday, July 21st, 2012. Pancho Ramos is becoming officially vegan.
Wow.
There's a round of applause for that.
Yeah. Thank you, John, for facilitating my growth.
Thank you, Pancho.
We heard it here first, man.
Wow. Hey!
You know, they say these calls cause ripples, but that's definitely one of the most instantaneous we've seen in quite some time. You know, John, you've been talking, you know, obviously a lot about nonviolence and, you know, working with, you know, with a troubled youth and people in prison. And I can't help but think about the incident that happened 2 days ago in Aurora. And I think all of our callers would love to sort of hear your take, that if you had an opportunity to maybe speak to both the shooter himself and perhaps the victims, I would be curious to hear what you would have to say from what you've gleaned over so many years.
Wow. Yeah. Let's see where to start. One, I don't think anyone can do something that terrible unless they feel terribly alone, and I don't think you can feel terribly alone unless something happened to you and you never revealed your pain. So, you know, how do you explain someone getting so lost and so disconnected that he would act out to that point? So I think, again, to me, he's like a canary. He's telling us there's not enough oxygen in the mind, and that if something isn't done, you know, we're all going to keep dying in terms of the hands of violence of even our own children. So I don't think any of those deaths are a waste totally. I think, again, it's a knock on our door that people feel isolated, they're lost. And the only way we come out of that is come out of the shame. And the only way to come out of the shame is to be with others. And we start healing when we start revealing our family pain. That family pain, it can send kids out into the street and do horrible things. And, you know, we have this infectious disease in our neighborhoods now, and it's spread through the city by what they call unprotected social contact. You know, it's bad information, bad role models, it's bad instruction, it's addiction to incarceration, to glamorizing death. It's passed on. It's passed on by deceit. It's passed on by the rules of survival. It leads to all kinds of things. So you have people acting out. Out, and then you have them also, you know, taking their own lives. So we have 30 kids a day, a whole classroom kids a day, who kill themselves, suicide. They don't ask for help. So there's a whole idea that until we listen, you know, to our youth stories, until we hear our elders' wisdom, we can expect more to happen. You know, there's no laws, there's nothing to protect us there. The only thing to protect us is connection. So what saddens me is we need to have public mourning and we need to have private mourning, but we don't really have any rituals in a mass scale to fall back on to publicly mourn this event, and we don't really have any trusted moral authorities that are visible that can tell people to to lay down their anger, to do that, and just let's just be with each other. And recently we had two students stabbed who were trying to help one of their brothers. And when I arrived at school, school officials hadn't got a response team together, but I knew a lot of the students who were in my female and male groups came, and they were bringing friends. Did you hear what happened, John? Did you hear what happened? And I go, no. And both were on life support, both these kids, so it didn't know which way it was going to go. So we just formed a circle. Anyone could be in the circle, and tens and tens of kids came, and what did we do? We just sat with each other and naturally in a circle. Nothing much was said for a couple hours. You could hear sobbing. People would go up and hug each other when someone new came in the room. And then I asked for, has anyone been in this situation? Can you help us? And then people started telling their stories of people who had been stabbed and shot and in the hospital. And then it was just the whole process. But we're very quick to politicize things and make people right and wrong. And so we never get to that point of understanding. But in my life, I've seen enemies become friends, colleagues, advocates for each other, because we sat down and we practiced sitting in a circle. So that's part of the answer.
Thank you. Thank you so much, John. That was beautiful. So again, I just want to remind people, if you have a question, just hit *6 to get on the queue.
Yeah, I have the magic wand now, Kanchan.
Go ahead.
Wow, John. Thank
you. Could you speak a little louder? I'm sorry.
Yeah. Can you hear okay now, John?
A little bit more volume would be good.
Okay. I'll step it up.
Okay.
Wow. Thank you, John, for helping our collective growth. It is, as you were engaged in that deep conversation, I was reflecting on, someone in the forest farmers is going to write up a beautiful blog, and this forest call is going to be, shared in the recorded form. And that's going to, go on, I don't know how many years, and at some point, somebody deep down in the generations is going to look up, read up about you, and, the story is going to start. Once upon a time, there is lived like this man, John, like a rock. And think about all the ripples that would bring about, and really resonated so deeply with what you shared with your personal interactions with Cesar Chavez. One thing I wanted to ask you, and also love that what you said about we don't train these runners for just running; they're running for service, and they get trained in service. John, I wanted to invite you to a quick conversation around as a everyday man, as a common man, wherever they are in any corner of the world, what is that we can do in specifically around the ritual in honor of the Mother Nature? Anything that comes up at this moment from your heart, I would like to receive it. And also echo what Pancho said. Really, you inspired us to step up our commitment to vegan and the whole plant-based food source. Thank you so much.
Beautiful. Well, on Thursday, I was working at the Wildlife Center, who's going to be starting a major garden and could use a lot of help and expertise, but there's plenty of land to start a garden there because kids need to learn the earth ethic, and they're learning some of that through the animals, but through the plant world needs to be listened to. But We have kids who are in emergency housing and in foster home situations. These are kids who, whose parents are unfit or they've lost a parent to violence and that sort of thing. So they've been learning the wild animals who've been injured and can't be released. They've been hearing their stories. And part of that is learning their behaviors, learning their needs, how do you care for these animals. And so on Thursday, I said, okay, you've told me what your favorite animal's in. And some kids had their favorite animal was a panda bear. Some it was a rat. Some it was a lion, that sort of thing. I said, okay, now imagine you are young. You are close to the truth because of your age. You are now speaking before the UN Assembly, and you are the voice of this animal who can't speak human language. They speak their own language. Now you as a human are going to speak to your own species. And these kids started speaking about why animals were important, that the animals were no different than us. They needed food. They needed shelter. They needed to be protected. And, you know, some got into habitat, some got into other things. But then we went into what's happening to the indigenous buffalo in Yellowstone, where we pay our government to harass through helicopters and those sorts of things. Our buffalo, our wild Mustang horses are herded by helicopters, you know, these things that aren't natural. So I would say, basically, we have to be the voices for nature at this point, whether it's the ocean that we're treating like a dump or allowing things to happen like our Navy practicing loud noises to disrupt communication, a Russian submarine or whatever, these things we want to dream up. And meanwhile, we know it's damaging and killing the dolphin, the whale, and all the other minor animals in the ocean. So we need to be a voice for the animal and the natural world. I guess that's my answer.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, John.
We have the next
question. Hi, John. This is Lavanya from Pittsburgh.
Hi.
Thank you so much for the. It's been really. I've been feeling really touched, and you know, my heart is responding very strongly to whatever you've been saying. I had a question about how do you think of, you've been talking about community and how to heal pain through actually talking to others or communicating with them. And what do you think is the relationship between solitude and community, and what is the balance between these two in the path that you are saying of, you know, living harmoniously with nature?
Okay, could you say that a different way for me?
I guess what I'm asking is, when we in most of the indigenous practices, whether they're American Indian or Indian, we speak a lot also about solitude. And I'm kind of wondering, what is your experience with balancing solitude and community?
Oh, solitude.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Wow, great question. Well, there's four healing solves, they say, and one is silence. And so we need to go in silence, whether it's the silence of the desert or the silence of the mountain. We do need to get comfortable within ourselves so that we never feel alone. So nature reflects back to us our own nature. So, yes, I think everyone needs to go out and be by themselves in the natural world and learn to talk to the animals, learn to talk to the trees, and they'll talk back to you. And so we need to listen. When we're out there, the natural world will teach us our own nature. You're too impatient. You have too much fear. You have all these things. So then if we listen to the natural world, we'll be fit to go out and serve. But I see a lot of people, they have good hearts and they have high ideas, but they have no practices. They run here and there. They're scattered. There's no focus. They don't have presence because they've left out the part of the natural world. So, yeah, we need a daily connection with the natural world. So my teachers always said if they were going to work with me, I had to spend a minimum of 4 hours a day out in the natural world. And so as far as the community, you know, people always want everything perfect before they start something. For me, you know, I've been offered jobs in different places, and I said, no, I'm going to stay in one place and be a simple man, and I just keep this little fire going. So I think a lot of times we think big is better, but I think simple is better. And when all electricity goes out, I think a lot of good things happen, in, you know, on the hill where I live. So I think local, you know, just starting a simple garden in a desperate neighborhood, I think that's more important than a big announcement on something else or flying across the world to give a 45-minute speech or something. So I think the earth reminds us to stay humble, humus, humble in our life work. So community, the number one thing is unity. So any leader who divides us is not to be trusted. A true community work is there's room for everyone in our circle. Everyone's voice is important. Everyone needs to be listened to. And if we aren't willing to bring the shadow, some dark, if people do dark things, if we're not willing to bring them in, they're not going to get better. They need to be around us.
Wow.
Thank you so much, John. It was such a wonderful call. I'm going to take like a few days to digest all the stuff that you have shared and maybe a lifetime to even start implementing half of it. Really grateful for this. So what we are going to do now is be in silence for a minute with gratitude for John. We've enjoyed community now, I guess. Now it's time to enjoy the silence. So a minute of silence. Thank you, everyone. So as we do every Saturday, what we are going to do is express our gratitude to John. So at a count of three, I'm going to unmute everyone and we get an opportunity to say thank you to John. One, two, three.
Thank you.
Muchas gracias, Juan. Ho, mitakesi.
John. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Thank you all. Have a wonderful weekend.